wind howls over a post-apocalyptic hellscape inhabited by mutos, dregs, primords. Field Major Steyr of the Sontaran Empire and the bandaged-faced traffic warden from Threads. You shelter below ground, waiting for rad levels to drop to safe levels. Alone, with nothing more than minimal food rations. And somewhat improbably, 5 stories from the Doctor Who universe in any medium. TV, audio, film, novel, comic book. These artifacts, they'll be your only link to the past. Maybe for the rest of your life. Welcome to The Bunker, a Doctor Who podcast from Cutaway Comics, brought to you by Bamalan Productions. And now, here's your host, Ian Winterton.
This week's interview is with Paul Simpson, writer, journalist, and currently the editor of brilliant website Sci-Fi Bulletin, a link to which you can find in the show notes. A well-known name in Doctor Who fandom, I've been wanting to get Paul on the podcast since we started it, but, as he references in our interview, he suffered a heart attack a few months ago that rather knocked him for 6. But, even though he just had major heart surgery a few days before, Paul contacted me to line up the interview, displaying a fighting spirit that's an inspiration to us all, both personally and professionally. So, without further ado, on to the interview. So, welcome to The Bunker, Paul Simpson. I've communicated with you many times via email. It's the first time seeing your face on Zoom, but hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. As I was just saying to you off mic, I'd normally read a big biog I'd written of your fantastic life, and but you have done a lot of different things. But how would you describe yourself? I mean, you've written 30 books, you've edited, you've...
I think the best description that I've sort of adopted is the one that Terence Dix used to use of himself: hack for hire. You know, I have quite a lot of knowledge of various areas. I've learned how to learn about other areas quite quickly and to digest that information and then regurgitate it in a form that is more accessible for people. So a lot of the books were on topics that I didn't necessarily know a lot about, but by going through and assimilating it all, I was then able to go, right, okay, this is how XYZ works. Obviously, Doctor Who has been at the heart of things all of my life. I'm a few days older than the show. So it has quite literally been around. One of my earliest memories is the 10th Planet. I don't remember from broadcast any of the other stuff. But yeah, before then, obviously, I've seen it all since. I interviewed Terence by the simple expedient of looking up his number in the telephone directory after I'd seen in the back of the hardback of one of the novels that Terence Dix lived in Hampstead. The A to D directory had Dix Terence spelt the traditional way, T-E-R-E-N-C-E, with an address and a telephone number, which I believe is still the same one, so I won't repeat it, even if it is stuck very clearly in my memory. And yeah, basically said, could I come and talk to you? And that was where it all started from. And that led to meeting Mac Hulk. That led to working with a lot of other people, going to the Target offices, meeting David Howe, and then a few years later getting involved with the infamous Dreamwatch, having been a fan and read DWB and everything like that. Dreamwatch then led into doing other writing work, books on the making of series like Farscape and Smallville and the Hitchhiker's Movie. So it was just one of those things that things just went from one to the other. Was invited to become editor of Star Trek magazine in 2006. And when that came to an end, I decided to keep a general sci-fi website going because Titan had had one called Total Sci-Fi, and they dropped it So Brian, Rob, Matt McAllister and I decided we would keep it going. Matt's career went in a different direction quite quickly. He dropped out very rapidly. Brian was involved for the first 4 years or so. And then I bought him out in 2016. And then since then, it's been extended considering there's now a large number of core writers on the site who basically, particularly in the last year while I've been ill, have been writing all the material. So, well, not all the material. I've done the odd little bit, but not that much. And we've gone from there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, obviously, Sci-Fi Bulletin is where I first. I'm compared to other fans, I'm quite late to embracing fandom. I was just interviewing Lisa McMullen from Big Finish the other day, and she's a similar, always been a Doctor Who fan, but only really embraced fandom like a decade ago. And so now I know of these names you're speaking of as legends. Although, you know, I've got David Howell the other day, in Gallifrey, and wonderful people like that, and Steve Hatcher, who himself said he never got into, he never went to a...
I've not been involved with organised fandom. My parents were very much against spending all this time on this stupid kids show. You'll never make any money from it, yada, 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 which it was quite nice to prove them wrong. But so I wasn't involved with fandom from the 80s through, really, only became peripherally involved when I was doing Dreamwatch. Mm-hmm. And I think that's actually always been an advantage, is that I've known people and there are, you know, people that I have had dealings with on and off for many, many years, but I don't have that shared, we've all done this, we've all bunked up at Blackpool type thing, which is, you know, it's a different set of experiences. I've done a lot working with Nick Briggs, and I count Nick as a friend, and we will chat about things which have nothing to do with Doctor Who or whatever. But again, I don't have the experience of the audiovisual plays and all of the stuff like that. So I've always been a little bit, quite deliberately, on the outside. And I've not actually most of the time found that a disadvantage. And certainly now, yeah, I worked with a lot of the writers on the, particularly the early BBC Eighth Doctor adventures. I was working with Steve Cole when he was originally editor and then later with Jack Rayner. So I was working professionally with people. And then quite often I'd hire those same people to come in and work on Star Trek Mag or SFB or whatever. So it was it's been a very good career of working with professionals who all have the same core fan interests.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's all that shorthand that saves a lot of time, I would imagine.
Oh, yeah.
But you talked about your earliest memories being the 10th planet regeneration,
it's actually the Cybermen in the snow is the image, because apparently it scared the living daylights out of my sister, and that's more the sort of memory. But
but it's so like lots of us, it's been part of your life since you can remember. Looking at interviews with you, with say, like the Smallville fan site and stuff, you sort of mentioned Terence Dix and Doctor Who in sort of paragraph one. So is it very much your origin story, your kernel of your being?
Yes, it is. I love the show. No matter how good, bad or indifferent it is, it's Doctor Who. And I will always, you know, that there's been a very, very short time when I didn't watch it live, literally the end of one season, the beginning of the next. And that was over 40 years ago.
So dare you say which?
Yeah, I gave up at the end of Creature from the Pit, episode one, which I thought was diabolical. And I caught the end of episode one of Full Circle, Andrew's script, and I've told Andrew this many times. That was, oh my God, this is Doctor Who. And that was it. And apart from circumstance, Warriors of the Deep, an episode of something, I can't remember, there was something else where I was literally just couldn't get to television. Mm-hmm. I've watched them live or near live, or been very privileged to have preview access an awful lot of the last 10, 12 years. Yeah. So yes, Terence is going back to that. Yes, Terence is very much the origin story. It showed me that I could ask sensible questions. It also taught me a valuable lesson about how to do it, because Terence very kindly, but very devastatingly, tore apart the first interview I did and said, no, that's not quite what I said. You're interpreting. You're not using the exact words. And he sat me down and we did it again. And he said, right, this time it's good. And I've always remembered that. And it's something that, as an editor, I've always tried to get across to people, is that nobody on this planet gives a darn about the interviewer. They are only interested in the interviewee. And you put that interviewee across in the best possible way that you can. Now, there are good writers, there are bad writers, there are good interviewers, there are bad interviewers. You can't make a great piece if the actual basic interview's been done badly. You can tweak it. You can do what I had to do with a member of the Voyager cast, Star Trek Voyager. I don't think there's any secret on it now. Jennifer Lean, who was suffering from various illnesses and left the show. And I met up with her for lunch with her mother in Pasadena. And she was giving literally one-word answers. And we realized that a large part of it, I was working with a photographer at the time, and we realized that a large part of it was because mum was there. Ruth, my photographic partner, smoked. So did the mum. So they went outside and had a cigarette, and I got an adequate interview in the 6 or 7 minutes it took them to smoke a fag. So, you know, you do what you have to do. But I don't genuinely think people are that interested in what I've got to think about Terence or Mac or whatever. I can give my impressions of the people and everything like that. But, you know, I wish I had access to some of the interviews that I did back in the late 70s. I'd love to have a complete list of all the stuff that I did for Dreamwatch in the late 90s. I had a hard drive failure and I lost a load of stuff. And that's a shame. Oh, I mean, I know the copies exist and I know somebody could transcribe them, but don't see that happening.
It's, well, you never know. I mean, there's the software available now. But yeah, I've got all my cuttings, the ones that aren't electronic. I'm like, one day I might scan those pages in, and they were just in a box and I probably won't get around to it. But that is the way it goes. But in this case, we are very interested in what you want to say. you are the...
Well, I gathered that, yeah.
Yes. And I'm the one who must stop rambling on. It's a podcast, so you're allowed to ramble on.
Warp Warp, the near-legendary Doctor Who fanzine, is back for its 5th issue. As always, it's a sumptuous, glossy, gorgeous feast of goodness, featuring in-depth articles on all manner of Who-related expanded media. Artist John Ridgway and writer Steve Parkhouse discuss their classic 6th Doctor comic strip, Voyager. And writer Alan Stevens takes us through the history of one of Marvel UK's most popular Whoniverse creations, Absalom Dak, Dalek Killer. There are 2 all-colour comic strips too, exclusively commissioned for Warp Warp. The Iron Legion returns in a 22-page story written by Lance Parkin and illustrated by Steve Andrew, this time pitting the rampaging Roman robots against the 12th Doctor, while Absalom Dak gets another adventure with the mighty John Ridgway on our duties.
Hey, Chainsaw Silversides.
On top of all of that, there's the full story of how Canadian animation studio Nelvana came very close to making an animated version of Doctor Who in the 1990s. As well as interviews with the project's key creatives, we've recorded the pilot script as an audio drama, accompanying the magazine as a cover-mounted CD. It stars British sitcom legend Arthur Bostrom as the Doctor.
Endless vast wastelands, distant nothingness stretching as far as the eye can see. Not very inviting. Could be Milton Keynes. No, the stars are all wrong. Very wrong indeed.
Continuing our dedication to the printed form, Warp Warp 5 is only available as a physical copy and can be ordered from anywhere in the world for the UK price of £10.99 plus shipping. For more information and to place an order, visit warpwarp.co.uk. The link in this episode's notes will take you straight to the shop. Or, for our overseas readers going to Gallifrey 1 in Los Angeles in February, the Cutaway Comics team will be there with piles of Warp Warp 5s for sale, as well as all our other comic book lines. So, see you in the dealer's room. And the bar.
But in terms of your choices to take into the bunker, I've sort of put them in an order. And I put Pyramids of Mars first because it's, well, actually, would you disagree? Dalek Invasion of Earth, the movie, the Cushing movie, is one of your choices, which was 1966. Would you say is that an early part?
No. Pyramids was when you asked me to do this, that was the instant answer. Mm-hmm. To me, it has its faults. It has elements that generations younger than us will take exception to, mm-hmm. that we might, not necessarily excuse, but we might understand more than others will. And I certainly don't want to get into that discussion. But to me, Pyramids of Mars is the epitome of Doctor Who in the classic era. It's Bob Holmes, as we know now, absolutely on fire. Tom and Liz at the absolute height of their reign. Gabrielle Wolfe just devastating as Sutek. And because I've been a church organist all my life, it's got some terrific organ music that I can really annoy people by playing again.
Oh my God.
Da, 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 da. Which before Midnight Mass does throw anybody who knows.
They expect the robot mummies to stop filing in at the back.
Exactly. Yeah, I did do that once and somebody recognised it, which did slightly throw me.
I imagine they're a friend for life now. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that story I have watched, I have no idea how many times. It's easily three figures, I would think. I can remember, yeah, I watched it for the 40th anniversary. I watched it for the 50th anniversary. It's on my list of ones I'm going through this year as a sample story for the 60th. When they did before BritBox, there was the BBC thing, I can't remember what it was called now, but where you could basically, what day they had the classic series on. First one I went in and watched was that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I know it. I know it inside out and backwards.
Yeah, me too.
I say it's on my list.
Yeah, I'd say it's on my list. I probably haven't watched it as many times as you.
But that's always going to be the case with somebody's favourite. Yeah.
But you were, one of the things about these interviews is how much everyone's lives intersects with this show, because you were the perfect age when Pyramids of Mars transmitted, yeah. I would say. Whereas
it's probably a large reason why it's one of my favourites. I was 12. Not just that, but the novelisation was the first of the books that I bought from the Target offices in Hammersmith the following year, 4 weeks pre-publication. So I had that and The Making of Doctor Who, you know, at the end of November.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, there are just so many reasons. I mean, God bless Chris Achilleos. It's not his strongest piece of artwork, but it's a very evocative one. It's one that I've yet to see a bad image evoked by. Yeah, there's not that there have been times when the characters from it haven't perhaps been used to their best. And I will be diplomatic about that, because that could apply to novels, comic strips, audios, whatever. And I would rather not be pressed further on that. There are some of those that, yes, I've really enjoyed and thought, yes, that really follows on from what was being done. And there's others where I want to go, will you sit down and watch the damn thing? Yeah, and that, I'm afraid that's, I'm a curmudgeon now. Yeah, I have a firm belief that if you're going to do something in an extended universe of a show, then you have to get the show right. And I work proofing and occasionally other jobs on the BBC Doctor Who range, which has been a great privilege. I've thoroughly enjoyed it. It took me ages to get the gig. And it's the one gig that I have done throughout this year, or throughout the last year since my heart attack. The first job I worked on were the new Target novels that came out last summer. Yeah, I wasn't doing anything else, but those three, they were happening. And yeah, you can expand, but if you break things, then I'm afraid my sympathy, and I think a lot of fans' sympathy goes.
Yeah, tone is key to, well, to many things, but to Doctor Who spin-offs especially, because I think the show can be so many things to so many people that you can get the era of it wrong if you're more from another era.
It's something that I know, you know, there are instances out there, and again, I'm being diplomatic about how I phrase this, of a story coming out where side material reveals that it was originally pitched as a story for a different Doctor and companion or companions.
Mm-hmm.
And quite often you experience that story and you go, yeah, it should have been kept for that team because it's a story that works for that team. And not every... Terence is absolutely right. The Doctor is the Doctor is the Doctor. Whether it's Jodie, it's Shuti, it's 10 Mark 79. Yeah, whoever it is inhabiting the body as an actor, the core principle of the Doctor is pretty much the same throughout. There have been moments when that's perhaps been slightly lost. Those are moments where perhaps the show has been weaker. But I've been going back to Pyramids. It's got some nonsense moments. It's got one of the first times I can really think that I thought, how's the Doctor going to get out of this? The end of episode 3, where he kneels before Sutek. And it's sort of, they've established the threat. They've established the thing. Sarah is on Earth. How is he going to get out of this one? And, you know, that's cliffhanger. That's the Flash Gordon serials that were on, you know, school holiday mornings when I was a kid growing up. Yeah, you know, it's what Indiana Jones builds into. And when cliffhangers on Doctor Who are used well, they can't be beaten. And I'm really, really, one of my real hopes is that with Russell's return, whether it's for the David trilogy or it's for Shuti's series 14, that we get some good cliffhangers.
Yeah, no. I mean, we've had some good ones during New Who, as they call it. The ones that always stick out in my head as not being great are, I guess in Kinder and things like that, where you have a threat for 2 seconds and then you tune in next week and it's the threat is eliminated because it wasn't really a threat and all that kind of thing. And he's got a sword at his neck. No,
there's millions of examples. Yeah, the story is, well, I mean, the best one is the description of the Time Meddler episode, which Hartnell's not in, where I think it's the About Time thing basically says the cliffhanger comes when they can't take the story on any further without him. You know, yeah. it's that thing. But anyway, yes.
So Pyramids of Mars was you were absolutely at the right age. For me, it's because I'm Generation Target, probably even more so than you, because we relied, like, that era of Doctor Who, there were no repeats. I was too young to watch most of it. I remember things like Horror Fang Rock and the Zygons, but they're all things that were fleshed out in, you know, and Pyramids as well, fleshed out by the Target books. So like yourself, but not actually literally, I was sort of mentored by Terence Dix, like many people. He was in my head as the person when I was writing my stories.
I think that he felt proud, quite rightly, of the number of people who had told him that they had learned to read or they had enjoyed reading because of his work. And I genuinely think that as an author, there is no greater compliment that can be paid.
No, I mean, I'm very jealous of you knowing him since you were 12, did you say, when you first went?
Yeah, when I first met him.
Yeah, I mean, I met him. I was supposed to go to the event at the Lasagari in Manchester, and I got stuck in traffic and I arrived just as he was leaving. And I managed to say, "You taught me to read," or something garbled, and he went, "Thank you very much." And then he got in his taxi. And that was my only moment meeting the amazing Terence. But yeah, he did teach probably millions of us to read. over the years. Just one, only just seemed wonderful. But moving on to your next one, I guess, shall we go for Dalek Invasion of Earth 2150?
Yeah, why not?
AD? When did you first see this, and why is it on your list?
I would think that the first time I saw it would be the BBC One transmission. So in the early 70s, which was really when I was getting into the show. The Target books were out, well, the initial 6, 9. And Doctor Who and the Daleks and Daleks Invasion Earth turned up. Certainly when it aired in 76 or 77, I actually sat down and transcribed it, start to finish. There's just something... Part of it is actually something that's very simple, is, as I mentioned, I'm a church organist. The piece that got me wanting to play the organ is Bach's Toccata and Fugue. That's also the beginning of Dalek's Invasion Earth. Yeah. It's the muse, Bill McGuffey uses that music for the opening robbery and then for the reprise at the end. So that always lent itself to me because it was a take on a piece that I loved. I think it's a marginally better movie than the first one. I think the Daleks are more accurate to themselves. Now, we all know the reasons for that now. And, you know, there's been the new John Walsh book, which has gone into the details of it. But it's being run by Legend on Sky at the moment. On Sunday afternoon, it was. And my wife and I were watching something, finished whatever it was we were watching live, put on the TV guide, Daleks Invasion Earth. I just put it on. And I sat and watched Raiden the Saucer up to when the spacecraft blows up.
Yeah. I mean, those movies were, again, because we didn't get... Do you ever get really jealous of Australians and Americans who got to watch TV, got to watch Doctor Who on repeat, on loop, on their TV networks? And we were cheated.
No, because we didn't know it. We didn't know it was there. You knew that, not Australia, certainly, but, you know, you knew in America that things repeated. Forget Doctor Who, but Star Trek and whatever, stuff like that. But that just wasn't what happened over here. So, no, I didn't get jealous of it because I've never actually seen much point in that sort of take on it, because quite honestly, they had it, we didn't. It's a shame that some of the stuff never got back. And looking at it from my grand old age now, I wish that more copies had been taken of things, but I don't regret what never was going to be. What might have been, maybe, but what never was going to be. You know, equity rules were quite clear. You know, we got the five faces of Doctor Who, which none of us expected to get.
And that's where a lot of us saw, you know, Hartnell era for the first time, and so much for the first time. But for me, Dalek Invasion Earth, the Peter Cushing, never seemed to be off the TV. So it was really absolutely thrilling every time it came on, and just absolutely loved it. Just, it's, you know, I can still watch it over and over. I show it to my own children now, and there's something about the funkiness and the colours, and the Daleks are menacing and running around streets, and there's even something about the guns, the fire extinguisher type guns, that's sort of makes sense. They're squirting you with poison gas or whatever it is they're doing.
doesn't really matter, but you see the effect of it.
Yeah, it works. It's absolutely brilliant. I take it you have shiny new Blu-rays of the new version, or the new
again. I'm lucky enough. I had preview discs.
Yeah.
So yes, I must admit that when they came out, I did say, "Could I have preview discs?" I was lucky enough to get preview discs. I didn't have the edition that got Rob Sherman's narration on it from a couple of years ago, so I was pleased to have that. And Rob and I haven't caught up properly since I watched them, so there should be a little bit of joking going on about that at some point soon.
Yeah. Well, talking of Rob Sherman, your next choice is Chimes of Midnight. The audio.
Gee, you think I'd done this before, wouldn't you?
It's amazing. It's
amazing.
Funny. I feel like I've been led like a child. Chimes of Midnight, the amazing Rob Sherman. You're not the first person to choose this amazing audio. Lisa also a friend of Rob Sherman, chose Chimes of Midnight as well. So of all the big Finnish audios...
Until the Heart Attack, I reviewed every Doctor Who release, every Torchwood release. Since then, Alastair Stewart has kindly taken over Torchwood, and I'm very slowly working my way through the Doctor Who's. I'm about 9 months behind at the moment. I have listened to their output. Not only did I get them previews, but for many, many years, I bought them to support the company because I felt that was the right thing to do, but also because I felt it gave legitimacy to my criticisms. You know, if you've not paid anything for it, then it's a bit harder to say this is good, bad, or brilliant or indifferent. When you've shelled out your own $14.99, I think you do have a right to say it. And, you know, I will give everybody there their due for listening to criticisms. They may not always agree with them. I'm not always going to be right. But what I do bring to Big Finish criticism is 60 years of watching, listening, reading, and editing Doctor Who professionally. So, you know, when things get through that shouldn't, I'm afraid I'll get caught. But if there's a great story, you know, if it breaks continuity point, it doesn't matter. If it's telling a good story and it adds to the universe, but going back to what we were saying earlier, if you try to emulate something or evocate, whatever, and you don't get the core of what it is right in the first place, then it's not going to work. But we've had some wonderful things. Yeah, there's been some ideas that I've just thought, how in the ever living hell are they going to do that? And they've done them brilliantly. Occasionally, not so much. But Chimes of Midnight, obviously, is one of the very earliest. It's one of the earliest Paul McGann's. It's at a time when the show wasn't coming back. Yeah, and that context is important because with the Eighth Doctor range, with Gary Russell running it, they had the opportunity to create the future of Doctor Who. And there's the infamous story of Steve Moffat going to the initial meeting and leaving when he realised they didn't have McGann because all that the things were going to be were past adventures. The one before it, Storm Warning, Alan Barnes' story, is a fantastic introduction to the Eighth Doctor in the persona he's in. Remember, at that point, all we had was a couple of short stories that Steve Kohler commissioned on Earth and Beyond, which Paul had read, but there'd be no all-cast drama. The Radio Times comic strip that Gary had done had finished. The novels were going in their own direction. And suddenly we had McGann on audio. We had McGann on audio with a foil that was far more than just a foil. In both Alan and Rob's hands, Charlie felt from the start like a three-dimensional character. What we saw Charlie doing in Chimes of Midnight, or heard Charlie doing, in places were things that you might not have thrown a companion in for some time. And it's a lead down towards things like Scherzo or whatever, where you have got a TARDIS crew who that you believe that you want to spend time with. And quite honestly, I adore the Peter Davison era. You know, I've spent time with the actors. I've, you know, done various things over the years, but the core setup of it, of four people in the TARDIS console room who didn't really like each other, to me doesn't work as a core for the show. You know, and then you take it, you ramp it up even further and have a sixth Doctor who is actually actively nasty.
Yeah.
And quite sensibly, that's pulled back. And you know, just a very side thing, you know, one of the other ones that I thought about would have been a Colin story, perhaps Marion conspiracy. Jack Rayner's absolutely brilliant suction for Maggie Stables. And, you know, that would have been one of my second choice probably as an audio. But I did think we ought to have an audio in here. And as I say, Chimes of Midnight, it's a good story. Rob is, you know, one of the best storytellers that Big Finish has ever employed. You know, read his stuff. Read his Thousand Stories book, where you basically, it's a choose your own adventure, and you get to the end of one and you decide what story you're going to go to next. So no two routes through the stories are the same. Absolutely brilliant writing. And you can see that in this. So that for me, it also, I used to have a tradition. I worked for some time at a church that was about 25 minutes drive away. So on Christmas midnight mass, I had to drive over and drive back. Christmas morning, drive over, drive back. I would listen to it at that point. So it also has clicked into memories of things like that. Not anything specific, but it is just a story that is tied nicely.
Yeah, I've seen a few people mention it. So it's a sort of Christmas listen for them.
Yeah.
Something's coming. A threat like no other. It will take a team of the most unlikely warriors in creation to defeat it. The universe is depending on you. On you! On you!
Coming soon from Cutaway Comics, Phase 1 of an epic new saga, Gods and Monsters. Issue 1, Faustine, Princess of Tharin, written by Stephen Gallagher, with art by Martin Geraghty. Issue 2, Sutekh the Heretic, written by Ian Winterton, with art by Adrian Salmon. And issue 3, Omega El Trala, by Mark Griffiths, with art from the legendary John Ridgway. An epic clash of good and evil that threatens to rip apart time and space. Coming soon. Follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe or visit cutawaycomics.co.uk.
So, Tides of Time, you've got a comic book iteration. What's your relationship with Doctor Who in comic book form?
As a kid, I'd pick up the TV comic special and realize that they've drawn Tom Baker over John Pertwee and things like that. I thought that when DWM started, sorry, Doctor Who Weekly started, that the Iron Legion was one of the best things in it. Yeah, the magazine took its time to find its feet. But the comic strip didn't. The comic strip went off, you know, from the start. And of course, we've got a sequel to that coming up in 4.45.
Yes.
Quick plug there.
Have you seen it already? Or
No. I've put my order in.
I've
get a review copy to go through early, but
well, I'm sure. Yes.
But no, I you know, the Vorp is one of my.
I've seen quite a lot of the PDFs.
Yeah. Oh no, I've got all the hard copies. You know, I have a complete set. Because I love the history of it. I love the fact it is people who are creative in their own fields coming in and doing something different with it, completely unrestricted by the budget. The Peter Davison stories on television, as I said a few minutes ago, obviously I hadn't made that connection before, weren't necessarily, in terms of the dynamics and everything like that, what I had perhaps been looking for. Didn't mean I didn't enjoy them. Earthshock would be one of those up on my list as a regular rewatch. But Tides of Time, there was something about it. And I really cannot place it. Whether it was just the totally unexplained, and as far as I know to this day, unexplained use of Zoe in it. Mm. It's just the ending where... he's back up as a knight on the wall and the poem is there. And there's just something about it that it's got a scope, an epicness that really spoke to me at that age. Now, I haven't read it in a long time. I've read Voyager far more recently than I have Tides of Time. I probably will go back. If I remember rightly, it came out as one of the special editions of the Doctor Who Complete History.
Yeah,
it's a subscription thing. So I've got it, but in some ways that's a memory. I quite like to keep as a memory from that period.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's I don't think I've read it except probably a long, long time ago. I certainly don't have a copy of it. But I see the book, the sort of compilation that it's part of. It's got two of our cutaway artists, Martin Geraghty cover with colours by Aid Salmon. So it's definitely one I'm going to go and see if it's.
Oh, it's. It,
if
yeah,
it's
if
a
you
fortune
haven't experienced...
on the internet.
It's like lots of these things. Yeah, and I'm sure you're the same. There are films, there are books, there are many other things that I have read or watched or experienced over the years that I am very glad that I have once, and I have not the slightest intention of ever doing again. There are Doctor Who stories that I will only ever go back into if it's work.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say I was working on a, I don't know, like Justin's 365-day calendar a few years back, which had quotes from across the show. So I went into a couple of episodes there that I hadn't seen in years, because the job is to check it's accurate. So, I wouldn't say that The Tides of Time is one that I would necessarily choose while I am in current bunker of stuck here. But if I were in a, you know, going into buying into the fiction, the situation, yes, I think it's one that I would enjoy going back to after 40 odd years.
Yeah, I mean, Dave Gibbons, I mean, I think what you were saying earlier about how the magazine and the weekly found its, the comic side of it found its feet immediately is, I think, you know, people like Des Skinner sort of tapped into all those famous, those now famous, that creative pool of Steve Dillon and the people that, you know, that also made 2000 AD such a success. They sort of tapped into that amazing talent of art. I mean, Gibbons's artwork, in you know, what I've seen on the internet of Tides of Time, that picture of, is it Satan? The big fat Satan?
Well,
Satan, yes. Yeah, that's right, yeah. And that's just such a, I mean, that's a picture that just gets repeated over and over as, here's Gibbons doing Doctor Who, it looks amazing. Moving on to your last choice, which is wonderful introduction to me. I'd somehow never heard of it, but the Dalek Conquests audio with Nick Briggs, absolutely wonderful. As I told you in an email, it gave me such a lovely, we had to go over to my mum's for New Year's Day, and it gave me such a lovely ride with my 7-year-old son listening to the history of the Daleks on audio. My wife wasn't so impressed. But for me and myself...
Oh, it was on the car when it was Sophie, my daughter, and I. She was born 2002. Mm-hmm. So she basically was brought up with the new series. But to her, the show is the show. So because we obviously had everything that was available, she would watch that week's Tennant episode and then go and get a Hartnell story off the shelf and watch it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and it was wonderful, and you know, seeing that. But the Dalek Conquests was a really well put together edited version of Dalek history with suitable quotes. And for Soph, that was the Dalek music. That was what she called it. And we would have that on. And we would normally have the first disc on rather than the second. But yeah, I heard that so many times. I told Nick about it years later. He went, "You must have hated me by the end of it." think that I couldn't possibly comment.
Oh, it is genuine. Maybe I'm a slightly more new to it, but my 7-year-old put down his tablet, listened to it, and now, because he's the only person that has the Alexa in his room, he has his Audible. He listens to Audible audiobooks. And he has requested, off his own back, has requested Dalek Conquest quite often.
Yeah. Not surprised. I am really not surprised. It is, if I remember rightly, they tried to do a couple of other similar things. I think they tried to do one with the 11th Doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't looked yet. I mean, it's still sitting in the CDs that came out the car. It's lived in the car, you know, in the 15 years since, and moved from car to car. It is just, this is how you do it.
Mm.
And going back to the bunker and all of that, it was a way, it reminds me, when I do hear it, it reminds me of sitting there with Sophie, you know, in the same way that other things have reminded me past. And Doctor Who has been so intertwined in my DNA that, you know, it is part of my life. And if I were to end up in the bunker with Primords and very small jelly monsters coming after me because the budget's been cut, you know, that would be what I'd listen to.
Yeah. And it's a cunning way of getting lots of different doctors as well. But it's absolutely, I would urge anyone to go and go and purchase it. $7.99 to renew your Audible. That's all I paid. And over 2 hours of absolute entertainment.
Yeah,
brilliant. But I've taken up enough of your time, and I know your best of luck with your health and everything.
Thank you.
But it's been brilliant to meet you.
Likewise.
I hesitate to call you a legend, but you are in the fandom, and but absolute pleasure to meet you over this Zoom link.
Okay, Nick.
Brilliant. Oh, brilliant to meet you.
Cheers.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
You have been listening to The Bunker from Cutaway Universe. Your host has been Ian Winterton. Produced by James Steventon of Bamalan Productions. Gods and Monsters advert voiced by Brian Blessed. All music by Paul Phillips. For more on Cutaway and to buy online, visit cutawaycomics.co.uk or follow us on Twitter at Cutaway Universe. Thank you.